Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund, and what happens when we're kids can come back to haunt us. Ask this guy.
I first found out about it trying to get into college.
That's Zachary Friesen with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Something that happened when he was 7 years old led to a financial nightmare years later.
I first found out about it trying to get into college.
So what happened to 7-year-old Zachary? Was it A, identity theft? Someone bought a $40,000 houseboat in the little kid's name. Or was it B, the state seized his assets? California said the treasury bonds he got at birth were unclaimed property. Or did little Zach C, get a credit card and then forget to pay off the 20 Smurf dolls he charged to it for 10 years? The answer is just a few minutes away on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
They're cute and cuddly, they coo and cry, but babies are something else too. The perfect target for identity thieves. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So you think you know all about identity theft. You watch for unusual charges on your credit card statements. You've stopped using your social security number so casually. Maybe you even signed up for one of those credit alert services. But what about your kids? They have identities too. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on a crime that's as easy as stealing from a baby.
Think these innocent little tykes are too young to have bad credit? Think again.
Uh-oh.
By the time Zachary Friesen was 7 years old, he'd already bought a $40,000 houseboat, or at least someone posing as him had. All it took was a name and social security number.
10 years down the road, I first found out about it trying to get into college.
Friesen is now a senior at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
I was denied, a student loan. I was denied a job. I filled out the application. I came back the next day. They said they couldn't give me the job because I was $40,000 in debt.
The Federal Trade Commission says 5% of the identity theft complaints it received last year involved minors. That's almost 250,000 complaints. And that's just the people who called in. Children are ideal victims because their parents may not discover the crime for years. Michelle Bartelheimer was lucky. She tried to open a savings account for her daughter when she handed over the 3-year-old Social Security number.
The teller came back and told me that number was already in use by someone else.
So what kind of creep would steal a 3-year-old's identity? Bartelheimer never found out. Linda Foley is founder of the nonprofit Identity Theft Resource Center. She says about half the calls her group receives involve family members, maybe a father who wants to start over using his kid's identity.
And a lot of them, I think, know the reality in the back of their head, which is, if I didn't pay my own bills, I'm probably not going to pay these bills either.
But it's not that hard for strangers to access private information. Foley says if your child's school or doctor asks for a social security number, make sure there's a valid reason and don't carry your child's social security card in your wallet or your own card for that matter. Michelle Bartelheimer wonders if children should be assigned those dangerous 9 digits at all.
As a mother, I'm required to get a social security number for my infant, but yet there's no protection there. It's like handing him a loaded gun and saying, well, we hope that you can, keep that safe till you know how to use it.
Linda Foley's group is working with Congress to change that. She says legislation in the works would provide credit bureaus with a list of Social Security numbers belonging to people under 18.
So when the credit issuer calls and says, we would like to verify an application for credit, what they'll say is that Social Security number belongs to a minor.
Until then, Foley offers parents some advice. If unpaid bills or credit denials start arriving in your toddler's name, you might want to order a credit report. It takes a lot of paperwork, but the credit bureaus will eventually erase any fraud from a minor's credit history. But Foley says don't go willy-nilly requesting credit reports unless you've got good reason to suspect your child's been a victim. If overdone, credit checks themselves can raise a red flag. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Today we turn the page for Chapter 4 of our financial fairy tale. Our hero and heroine, Michael Fox and Tiffany Ljunggren, will tie the knot in just a few weeks on September 1st. We're following them as they walk toward the aisle to have and to hold through sickness and health and revolving credit card debt. We're back in the kingdom of Encinitas, California, where Mike and Tiffany are hosting a dinner for their wedding officiant, Ben Kiroff, and his girlfriend, Liz.
What's up, Tiffany?
Hi.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Hi,
Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. Welcome.
Ben had a little show and tell for the couple, his newly minted license to conduct the marriage.
So I did this today, in fact, so you can see it says, Reverend Benjamin Kiroff has been ordained this Saturday, the 14th of July. So, yeah, I just went to the link that you gave me.
Themonastery.org. Tiffany's known Ben since kindergarten. She and Mike didn't want a typical church wedding, so throughout a meal of crepes filled with zucchini, tomatoes, and goat cheese, they went over the ceremony that will take place at her grandfather's home. Now that they'd met with their officiant, I asked whether they had any plans to meet with a lawyer.
Everyone keeps telling us we should. It's kind of funny, the people that have told me to sign a prenup, for the most part, have been bitter divorcees. I don't really like the idea because it seems like during this time of celebration and joy, that would put a big damper on things. But I do know that I think the statistic is that 50% of marriages end in divorce. So, you know, we got a 50-50 chance of staying together. So a lawyer kind of makes sense.
It doesn't matter to me. Like, whenever I hear lawyer, I always think money. So when I think, hey, I'm going to be paying how much for you to write up a thing that I may never use, it depends on what the cost would be.
I thought about just composing something that, you know, delineates what our assets are individually, but I guess we have to do a little more research and find out before the big day, and that's only 6 weeks away, so.
Which is a good question, because even though it's called prenuptial, I wonder if you could actually do it after your wedding.
You can. It's called a postnuptial.
There you go. So that seems like an option, too, because we really are busy on a day-to-day basis.
Last time we talked, we met at the wine store. You were picking out your wines, and then you were on your way to taste your food. How did that go?
Mwah, mwah, mwah.
Uh-oh.
It didn't go well. My parents had chosen a place that they were told would be a very good deal, and we were completely willing to go along with it until we tasted the food, and neither one of us liked the food. So we asked my parents if we could try some other places and were firmly told no. Then we found out that my parents had already put down a deposit on that restaurant.
And this is, we talked last time about the fact that, Tiffany, your parents were planning to pick up the majority of the tab for the wedding.
Yes, they're still planning to pay for the caterer and the rental vendor. But now the situation has changed, and we're picking up the tab for a lot more than we had anticipated. Mm-hmm. And it's been tense, and things aren't going as smoothly as we had hoped. But I think that a lot of people probably go through this. It's a very stressful time.
If you're now going to be paying for a larger chunk of the wedding than you expected to, are you prepared for that? Do you have the money?
We are very fortunate because I just got a job freelancing that will pay me several thousand dollars. that was just a matter of great timing, because otherwise we would have been putting it on credit cards, or Mike's parents have offered to pay for whatever we need. But I would rather not have them pay.
So with 6 weeks to go, the inevitable stress has set in. But they did want to address one of our listeners who doubted their claim that their wedding would cost way less than the $28,000 average.
I know how much this is costing. It's not a mystery to me. One of the things that we saved a lot of money on, that people spend a lot of money on, is a venue. We're not paying a dime for it.
We have not been hesitant at all to ask our friends for help, and we have a family friend who was a former AP photographer who's going to be doing our portraits and photos. And we have my mother's brother coming in as the DJ. We also have a friend of the family who will probably be helping us with the flowers. My mom is making my wedding gown. And I think the gown was upwards of $5,000, and really now it's just the cost of the fabric.
They also printed their own invitations, 150 of them, for about $200. We've got a photo on our website. Next time, marriage, money, and secrets. Oh, and the honeymoon. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school's in session. This week we're exploring something you might think relates to junior high gym class. It's called the P.E. ratio. You'll hear the term a lot this time of year as companies announce their quarterly earnings. At the blackboard this week, economist Chris Lowe.
It is a ratio of the price of a stock to the earnings per share in that stock. It is the favorite measure of value in the stock market. You'll hear people talk about P.E. ratios for individual stocks and also for stock indices like the S&P 500, for instance. It's important and it's a favorite because it gives you a consistent standard of value that helps investors decide if they're paying enough or too much or even not enough. Maybe a stock is undervalued. There are some stocks where a higher P.E. ratio is justified, but it means you're taking significant risk, because what you're doing is you're betting that earnings growth is going to accelerate fast enough that that P.E. will look normal soon. Of course, the other way a P.E. could go from very high to normal would be if the price drops. So if someone's buying stock into a high P.E. company, there better be a pretty good reason to expect higher earnings in the future. Imagine Wile E. Coyote's favorite company, Acme Corporation, just released earnings at $5 a share. And the share price is $20 right now. So the P.E. would be the price divided by earnings, or 20 divided by 5, which is 4. The lower the P.E., the better, because what that tells you is you're getting more earnings for your investment dollar. So Wile E. Coyote's doing pretty well, assuming he's buying the shares. Of course, if he's buying the products, we all know how that turns out.
Our teacher this week was Chris Lowe. He's the chief economist with FTN Financial in New York. Next week, how gross is gross domestic product? Think that letter from your retirement fund is just more junk mail? Chris advises otherwise in the mailbag. And this guy serves cheese so good, you'll curse his name.
You know how you get sometimes when you taste something really good and you feel like yelling out a profanity? I love seeing people get that way.
A day in the work life of a fromager. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Noticed the price of pizza going up? Blame the cheese. It's the priciest ingredient in pizza, and it's getting pricier, as much as 55% more expensive than just last year. But on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we take you to a New York restaurant where diners don't typically go to save money, and where one man's making sure they get the best cheese money can buy.
If there is an aroma wafting across the table, it's most likely this guy right here, wrapped in spruce bark. This is one of those few cheeses that, like, you know, you taste once and you're kind of hooked. And there are only two wheels made of this cheese. Are you open to all types?
I am. Primarily the one you just raved about.
My name is Adrian Mercia. I'm 37 years old, and I'm the fromager at Chanterelle Restaurant. So my responsibilities as the cheese guy or fromager at Chanterelle is first to order the cheese, make sure that it's in good shape, also to set up the board when I come in to work around 4 o'clock, start pulling out the cheese and facing it, making it look nice. Another part of my responsibility is to educate my colleagues if I have new cheeses, which happens a lot, and also for service, to try to cheese as many tables as I possibly can. There are a lot of people who come into the restaurant who have preconceived notions about goat's milk cheese or blue cheese. Very often I can win them over. There are a few foolproof cheeses. One of them is Montenebro. It's a goat's milk cheese. It's got like this real spicy, dark, slimy, intense rind. But inside it's this pristine, snow-white paste that is definitely concentrated. It's definitely got some goatiness to it, but it has so much complexity. It's got sweetness. It's got this hazelnut component, and it just excites so much in the mouth that they love it. In a good year at Chanterelle, you can make, depending on how many days you're working, anywhere from $50,000 to $65,000 a year. We get a week off in the summer. They close the restaurant for a week. But I take off a little bit more than that. We can take up to 3 months leave of absence without losing seniority. And seniority is important. Most senior people get the choice dinners. The most junior people work lunches. So seniority carries some weight. I like to see people get really excited and, like, you know how you get sometimes when you taste something really good and your body just sort of tightens up and you feel like slamming the table, you feel like yelling out a profanity when something is really good. I love seeing people get that way. I guess there was one incident that sticks out for me, and it happened about 3 years ago. It's been a while now. At the time, we were serving a triple creme cheese called Briette Savarin, pairing it with this honey from North Carolina. I had a table of three women who were really into the cheese from the get-go. And then when they tasted it, there was first a silence, you know, and then just this kind of a lot of movement back and forth and eyes closed and quite a memorable moment. They liked it. I guess the thing I like most about being a cheese guy is that I see people's eyes light up a lot. I guess I like to please, and cheese pleases for sure.
You can savor some of Adrian's cheese recommendations, unfortunately not the cheese itself, at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Daniel Weiss.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
A tug of war brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, say on pay. Say on pay is a proposal that's making its way through Congress. Let's say you own part of a public company. They're looking for a new CEO. And the wannabe chief is pushing for big pay and cushy perks. Really? Say on pay would allow shareholders to vote on a CEO's salary. And even though the vote wouldn't be binding, it's still not welcome news around the boardroom. Why? Because it could make boards of directors look worse if they ignore shareholder wishes. So some boards have their own proposal for shareholders. Shut up already!
Got a box full of letters. Thinking I'd like to read.
I'm Tess Vigeland, and I'm so glad to be back, although I have to say, vacation was great. But, you know, I missed hearing your financial questions. So now that I'm here, let's get right down to business. Hey, Chris, how's it going?
It's going well. You don't want to talk about horseback riding, hiking?
Actually, I would much rather talk about that, but I'll just have to put that in the past and say, you know what? It's time to go to work here. And before we get into answering any questions, go ahead and take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button, or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, Chris, you ready for this?
Yes, I am. I gave you a chance to change the topic, so I'm ready for any personal finance questions you want to toss my way.
All right, we'll talk about hiking and horseback riding later on. But first, we've got Brian on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian.
Hello there.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in Brookline?
Well, I am finishing my training. I just finished in pediatric cardiology. And I will be moving out westward, taking a new job starting in September.
Oh, where are you going?
To Seattle.
Wonderful. Well, you will certainly enjoy the great Pacific Northwest, I can guarantee you, as a former resident myself.
Sure. I hope we can deal with weather changes, but I'm sure it'll be a little bit warmer compared to Boston, and we should be able to live with that.
Well, tell us a little bit about your question for Chris today. I understand you have a 457B. And Chris, before we even start, let's explain what that is.
Okay. The 457B is a retirement plan. And in many respects, it's like a 401K, which is for private sector workers, or a 403B for a lot of nonprofit workers. 457Bs have been concentrated in two sectors of our economy. One, state and local governments. The other is in certain nonprofits like hospitals. You can have 457Bs that are targeted toward what we call the top hat workers, your more highly compensated employees.
All right. Well, Brian, I'm going to make an educated guess that you were in the latter group, where perhaps a hospital?
I was a physician working in a clinic, actually.
Okay.
And it was a plan that I planned to hold for quite a long time. But what happened was the asset management company changed hands from my previous employer. The original management company was Charles Schwab.
And it transferred to?
Got transferred to T. Rowe Price.
All right.
Now, during that transition period, apparently they had sent literature about what to expect during that whole phase. And to be fair to T. Rowe Price, they did send some information saying, well, we are receiving your retirement money. What do you want us to do with it? I assumed, perhaps incorrectly, that they would hold on to it.
But they didn't?
No, they didn't. So about 6 months ago, I surprisingly received a check, which looked like a monthly distribution. And so to my surprise, I saw that and said, well, wait a minute. I'd like to keep this in the retirement account. So after multiple phone calls, a letter to the management firm, as well as talking to my accountant, I have been unable to reverse this trend.
So essentially, because they didn't hear from you, they just started dispersing your retirement money.
That's correct.
Oh, wow. Chris, is this par for the course? Is there anything he can do?
Well, I think this is, and I'm sure, Brian, you don't need me to be telling you this, but for our listeners, this is an object lesson with retirement plans. You get this literature. You do need to respond because there are these quirks and twists in the rules that can really get you in trouble. The one thing with a 457 that is different from a 401k or a 403b is there's no 10% penalty. So you'll owe taxes, but you don't pay a 10% penalty on early disbursement.
Okay.
Which would be the case with a 401k or a 403b. My guess is that it's irrevocable. If you're in what we call one of the private plan 457s, you can't roll that over into an IRA. If you were in a public plan, and this is why you would need to look at the documents or get back in touch with T. Rowe Price, what I would then explore, because you can roll those over to an IRA, whether you could roll over the remaining sum of money that's in the plan into an individual retirement account, a rollover IRA.
But he can't do that because he's not in a public plan.
I suspect it's going to be the latter, unfortunately.
I suspect it's going to be the latter, too. I'm actually grasping for a straw here. T. Rowe Price is every incentive to keep your money. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It sounds like it's an irrevocable disbursement that's going on.
Chris, is there anything that he can do? Can he re-put the cash, I suppose, into another retirement account? But then is it taxed later again?
No, then it's taxed later again. So at the moment, I can't think of anything that you can do. It's going to help pay for your move.
Oh, this sounds like a lesson that no matter how busy you are, you should keep appraisal of what's going on in one's accounts.
Yes. there are some weird aspects to these retirement plans, and unfortunately, we just all need to stay on top of them when you do get this kind of missive.
Okay.
So, Brian, are you going to be able to save through a new retirement plan?
Yes, I'm definitely doing that. I'm continuing to maximize when I can. It would have been nice to be able to keep this in those accounts, but I guess I'll figure something else out with it.
All right. Well, good luck, and thanks for the call. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Well, let's head to the email bag, and we've got Lynette writing in from Waconia, Minnesota. And she and her husband applied for a home equity line of credit, a HELOC with ING. But they noticed that in order to close the loan, they were required to sign what's called a limited power of attorney. And she thought maybe this was not a very good idea, so they chose not to go with ING. Is this something that a company can require you to do in order to get a home equity line of credit?
Now, I don't know the specifics about ING, but I do know a fair amount about the specifics in terms of taking out a home equity line of credit or a mortgage through a company that is not a brick and mortar company, but is essentially an internet company. The online process has been streamlined. There have been genuine advances made. Nevertheless, as far as I know, there's usually a piece here or a piece there where they're going to need a limited power of attorney to close the deal. Tess, you go to a closing.
Right.
And you're in a room.
Signing a huge stack of papers.
But now let's say you have a real journalistic opportunity. You're going to go abroad. Reporting chance of a lifetime. But you can't be there at the closing because you're going to be several thousand miles away.
So what do I do?
You give to an attorney or whomever, limited power of attorney. They're going to sign the documents for you. That's all they can do.
Okay.
They can't drain your bank account. You haven't given them durable power of attorney. You haven't turned your financial affairs over to them. It's in this very limited, specific circumstance that you have given. That's why it's called limited power of attorney.
And in this example, you're giving that limited power of attorney actually to ING.
That's right.
So it's not something that you should feel skittish about.
But then you got my caveats. ING is a very legitimate company. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with a company like ING. Okay, that gives me a level of certainty. If I don't know the name of the company, hey, I'm not going to give anybody limited power of attorney.
All right. Well, when we say we can help you, we mean it. And we definitely don't need you to sign any suspicious sounding paperwork. All we need is your question. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. We've got caller number two on the line. Tiffany is in Long Island, New York. Hey, Tiffany.
Hello.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Question is, I'm pregnant right now and expecting my first child in October.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great.
And both the grandparents are being quite generous and they want to help with the kids' education. One set lives in Canada and the other set lives in Australia. And my question is about sort of what the best plan is for them to do. And the other question is, something I've heard of people doing around here is taking life insurance policies out to pay for the children's education. And I don't know if that would be something that I could recommend them to do out of the country or if that's not a particularly good idea.
Okay. Well, let's start with the first question, Chris. You know, the biggest education plan that we tend to talk about on the show is what Tiffany referenced, which is the 529 plan. Is that something that you could contribute to fairly easily no matter where you are in the world?
Yeah, what I would do is set up a 529 plan, and then the grandparents in Australia and Canada, they'll be taking currency risk depending on when they want to make the contributions because – it would have to be in dollars. But that's the simplest, straightforward way to save for your child's college education. And it's the easiest way for the grandparents to contribute. And there really are not any issues. And when you withdraw the money, unless they change the tax law, which, you know, knocking on wood, they won't, the withdrawals will be tax-free. And the other thing that I like about 529 plans is it's pretty easy to shop for a good 529 plan that gives you good investment options and low fees.
All right. So that's the first question. And then, Tiffany, your second question was about getting an insurance policy to fund the college education.
Well, I'm not a big fan of it. It's out there. This is for an insurance policy that has a cash value. The classic being whole life. We get a lot of questions about variable life. And all this means is that there's a savings component to this life insurance plan. That savings component grows over time, and then when Tiffany or child goes to college, you would then borrow against the plan, and it's tax-free, and you pay for college that way. The problem that I have with that, I have several problems, and one is that an insurance policy, even though it has an investment account, it's really not a good investment plan. You know, some of that premium goes to pay for commissions, administrative costs. And so I think that the 529 plan is a far superior product. It doesn't mean you can't do the cash value, but I think the 529 is superior.
Okay. Does that help you out, Tiffany?
That helps me out a lot. Thank you very, very much.
Terrific. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, having a far-reaching plan is usually a good idea, but some people wouldn't even know how to get started. We can help. That's what we're here for. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag. Donald is writing in from San Carlos, California. And I think we've got a bit of deja vu going on here, Chris.
Okay.
Lots of movie sequels out this year, and we've got our own little one right now. Let's call it The Ring Part 2. Donald is 25, and he's got about $8,500 in savings. He doesn't have anything invested, only has one credit card with a limit of $5,000, nothing on it, no other debt. This is great so far.
That's impressive.
But against all his good instincts, and I think we would agree maybe these are good instincts, he's looking at purchasing an engagement ring that he feels is well outside his financial means. He's looking at a stone, Chris, that is priced around $7,500 and a setting that'll cost almost $2,000. So we're talking about a $10,000 ring. And just to remind everyone, the reason we're calling this a sequel is because several months ago we had a similar question. A man wrote in and he had already spent, I believe it was $4,000 on an engagement ring that he admitted he really couldn't afford. He's thinking about opening a second credit card with a higher limit and then maxing out both cards to finance the ring. What would you say to this?
Well,
I wonder.
I think he's making a terrible mistake. I really do. And I think that there are better options. Look, you're going into a marriage, a long-term commitment. Why would you want to go into that marriage spending on a ring more than you can really afford? Because, you know, by the way, as you know, Tess, weddings aren't cheap.
No, they are not. Average cost $28,000.
So buy a ring that expresses your love and your affection and has thought, but it's affordable. And then a couple years from now, you grow, you have some savings, and you can afford the $10,000 ring. I really think that one of the things you really want to try and do is establish, you know, some sort of money sentiments, because you're embarking on a lifelong journey where you are going to be mingling your money and sharing your money. And I think it's really, why add to the pressure by going into debt and buying something you really can't afford?
All right. Those are all the questions we can take for this week's show. But please leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit the contact page on our website, www.marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Des.
Sometimes it seems like buying a home is all about the paperwork, especially when you're looking at your mortgage contract.
This is massive. This is like the Magna Carta here, but bigger.
First time home buying on the latest Educating Rico. And imagine revealing every dirty secret about your finances. A financial blogger breaks the money taboo. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Once a month, our own Rico Galliano checks in to tell us about new stuff he's learned about personal finance. We call the series Educating Rico. Lately, though, he's been tracking his friend Rick's education as he goes from apartment dweller to first-time homeowner. Today, the final installment as Rick confronts one monstrous stack of papers, his final mortgage contract.
Hi, I'm Rico, and listen to this. That is not Rick's mortgage contract, because, you know, Rick has that. What you just heard is a phone book, an L.A. phone book, which is a reasonable approximation of the size of Rick's mortgage contract. Let's hear it again. You could kill a rat with this thing. The contract is so big, there are people whose job it is to help you sign it, like Leslie.
I am a closing assistant.
Yes, she is, and she was nice enough to let me tape her guiding Rick through the process.
This is actually going to be your copies of everything you're signing.
Okay. This is massive. This is like the Magna Carta here, but bigger.
Now, some of the mortgage papers are self-explanatory.
This, you need to verify this is where you want your taxes mailed to.
Okay.
But it wasn't long before the real estate speak kicked in.
These are the escrow instructions. There is the vesting on how you're holding the property. You should have received a copy of your CCNRs outside of escrow. Final subdivision reports. This is your settlement statement. There is a closing reserve. Your association dues. Compliance agreement.
Real estate commissioner's final public report, declaration of restrictions and any amendments thereto, and articles of incorporation, bylaws of the homeowner association. Yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Hundreds of pages of this stuff. And that wasn't even all of it. Rick got another 100 pages worth on a computer disk. Now, Leslie studied for 2 months to understand mortgage contracts. The rest of us mere mortals could probably use a cheat sheet to figure out which pages to scrutinize. So here to do just that is Cassie Welch. She is a real estate consultant and a mortgage broker right here in L.A. Hello, Cassie.
Hi, Rico.
So first of all, can you kind of break down a mortgage document into its component parts for us?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge that you're absolutely right. It's really overwhelming to have this huge packet of documents. And when I was thinking about it, it's really broken down into three. The first is the loan application and credit package. The second are disclosures. And the third part are the loan documents themselves.
Of those three, what's the most important?
I would say the loan documents themselves, because those are actually your promise to pay and then also how you're going to repay the money, the terms of the loan that you're getting.
All right. We'll get back to that in a second. But just really quickly, let's address the other papers in there. The application is?
That's basically the final loan application where everything is perfect about your income, your credit, your assets.
So that's like re-verifying all my financial info, all the buyer's financial info?
Exactly. And then you sign off on that. It's just another step for the lender having a surety that everything that you've said before is true.
And man, there are a lot of these disclosure things.
There are.
What are those?
They're the documents that tell you what you should be told. That's what they are. They're basically telling you what your rights are, whether it's fair housing, not being discriminated against, knowing that you're going to be receiving accurate information about what the loan is actually costing you.
All right. Let's get to the important loan documents. Firstly, I mean, do they say loan documents at the top? I mean, how do I know I'm looking at the loan document portion?
Well, the two most important documents that I would look at in terms of making, you know, the actual loan are the note, which is the promise to pay, and then the deed of trust explaining how you're going to repay the money.
So what are each of those?
The note ties the house to the loan. That's the collateral.
This is where they say, if you don't pay up, we're going to seize your house.
Exactly. The note, it's the actual document that people keep in the vault that is transferred from lender to lender if the loan's ever bought and sold. The deed of trust is the document that actually goes through and defines all the terms. It not only tells you the loan amount, but it also defines the interest rate, how many payments you'll be making, what they are, you know, and then also if it's an adjustable, it'll have a rider explaining how the adjustable loan works.
Are there any documents in there that kind of sum up everything important in one place?
The two documents also that really protect you from a financial standpoint are the truth in lending statement, which basically shows you the APR, which is the actual percentage rate, which factors in all the loan fees. And then the other piece is the HUD-1 settlement statement. And that breaks down all the fees to, you know, escrow, title, appraiser, the lender.
This is the document where I see, like, how many people are taking little pieces of my money.
Exactly.
Away from me.
And there will be some differences between that and the final. If you think you're going to close one day and you go a day late, you're going to pay a day less of interest and taxes and everything like that. But the fees themselves should not be changing.
Well, now here's the thing, though. Of course it shouldn't be changing. You know, for the last few months, I've watched Rick take phone calls literally almost every 5 minutes from his real estate agent and his mortgage broker about the details of this mortgage, hammering it out. By the time you get the contract, shouldn't it be just a matter of signing off on it?
Hopefully, if you've worked with a reputable person, there shouldn't be any changes. You should look at loan documents. It should be everything that you're expecting. Everyone else has already checked them from the lender to the escrow person when they receive the loan documents. So you're right. In theory, you should just be able to sign them. But honestly, when you're committing yourself to 30 or 40 years of payments, you don't want to give away your responsibility that way. You really want to check through it yourself.
And Rick did read it and ask questions. And the process took hours. As it should when you're putting yourself in debt up to your eyeballs. Finally, he put his name on the last dotted line and bid Leslie adieu.
All right.
Thank you
very much. Thanks for making the drive.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So how do you feel?
I feel like my arm is tired. I don't know. You know, at this point, I'm just relieved to have it done. I'm nervous. You know, whenever you see the monthly payment in front of you, you're like, oh, okay. But that's just a little incentive to not screw up my life.
In Los Angeles, where Rick's begun a new life in a sweet downtown loft, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
You can check out the first three installments of Rick's home buying saga online. We've got the welcome mat laid out for you at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
She has $8,313 and change in a bank savings account. Her coin jar holds $103.99. The mortgage on her primary residence is down to $277,003.68. You can find out every single detail of her financial situation at BostonGalsOpenWallet.com. Every detail, that is, except her name. She's 30-something, single, and part of a growing trend of anonymous online blogging about personal finances. Welcome to the show, and I guess I'll just call you Boston Gal.
Yes. Unfortunately, I reveal so many details about my financial history that I need to be anonymous. So I go by the anonymous name of Boston Gal.
Has anyone figured out who you are yet?
Not that I know of, and I hope not. That's the only thing that could keep me up at night.
Then why do this? Why open up your financial life to the world?
I think I did it a little naively at first, thinking no one will find me, no one will read this. And then once you start posting and other people start reading, you get these comments and emails from people all over the country and the world. And it's amazing how much knowledge there is out there and how helpful that can be. And I think once you start to receive help from people, you want to help others, which is really why I started it, because I was a little frustrated. I had for years been reading things like Money Makeovers and Your Portfolio. That was great. But how did that help somebody like me who was single, living on one salary, and really confused about what I should do for myself, for my finances, to make sure that I would be taken care of?
Well, then how does this help you?
It definitely keeps me accountable. Since I started my blog about a year and 7 months ago, my net worth has increased by over 100,000. Now, can I say that that's just from my blog? I don't know, but what I do know is I've been much more careful about how I spend my money and how I look at my money.
What prompted you to go this avenue in terms of helping yourself manage your money versus hiring a financial advisor or flipping through newspaper and magazine articles? I mean, perhaps it's a generational thing, but I think a lot of people wouldn't automatically think, oh, I'll start a blog and that'll help me manage my money.
Well, I think part of it was I discovered other blogs like mine. There was something about hearing personal stories and then being able to follow those ongoing personal stories and then being able to voice my own ongoing kind of money story. And frankly, finances aren't that interesting. But when you read how somebody else is doing it or trying to do it, at least I did, I found myself hooked. I found it very educational and inspirational.
Are your family and friends aware of who you are and what you're doing?
No.
Really?
No. In fact, I believe my family would be horrified, and I'm sure there would be some kind of intervention to get me off of this. And I think that was part of the reason why I did it, was because finances were never discussed. I think since I started the blog, I've done things like upped to the maximum my 401k contribution. It's not that I couldn't afford to do it before. I chose not to do it before. I just kind of have decided I can't keep doing that.
Why do you think that money is really one of the aspects of our lives that we don't choose to share publicly? you go to great lengths to make sure that you're anonymous, as do many other posters who blog about money. Why is that the area of our lives that we want to keep secret?
Well, I think the easy answer is a lot of people say identity theft or, you know, or jealousy. They don't want a coworker to know what they make or what you really have. And you can say, I can't afford this, or, you know, you can talk in general. Oh, I don't quite make enough to be able to go on that vacation. But to actually put hard numbers out there, I think, scares a lot of people. Because once you hear somebody else say how much they make, the implication is now you have to turn around and reciprocate. It's like when you say, I love you to someone, you want to hear them say, I love you back. So, and maybe that's the problem with money. People really don't want to know.
What do you think is the biggest thing you've learned about managing your personal finances by blogging versus anywhere else you might have learned about how to manage your money?
I think that I can manage my own money. I feel pretty good about what I've been able to accomplish so far, and I feel pretty good about what I can accomplish in the future. And it's not rocket science. You can do it, if, as long as you pay attention to it.
All right. Well, Boston Gal, thanks for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
We have a link to Boston Gal's site on our website. And if you've got a favorite personal finance blog, share it with us. We're at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. And Chris, you know, if we take a look at the economy, it's a pretty good story, isn't it? The stock market is up.
Yep.
Economy's growing, inflation contained. But, you know, these Wall Street economists get paid to worry, and they are still fretting about the job market. You want to explain this a little bit?
Okay, Tess. Here's what they say. There are more and more job openings right now and fewer workers to fill them. So it's what we call a tight labor market. And the worry is that this will lead to rising inflation. And believe it or not, this puts those Wall Streeters in the same camp as Karl Marx.
Oh, my. Karl Marx? Well, I am eager to hear your reasoning here.
Well, here it is. Marx said that capitalism depends on an army of unemployed workers. Well, what's the modern way of saying that? Well, you risk inflation if there's too much employment.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke testified about the state of the economy earlier this week, he said, and I quote, pressure in the labor market could lead to increased inflation over time. Well, I think he's wrong, and so was Marx. Here's the straight story. The definition of a strong capitalist economy is full employment. The current unemployment rate of 4.5% is too high, much too high.
Wow, and that is not what we hear from other economists. We often hear that 4.5%, hey, that's great.
Oh, and you hear it's getting too low.
Exactly.
It's getting too low. We have to worry about inflation.
Well, all right, so let's talk about the dynamic that these guys say is at work here. How does low unemployment lead to higher inflation?
Okay, here's the simple story. You have low unemployment. That means that companies are going to have to pay higher wages to attract workers. Or another way of saying it is that, you know, labor has some bargaining power. And then these higher wages encourage companies to raise their prices because now they have to pay for a more expensive labor force, and you end up with higher inflation. As you can tell, I don't agree with this, by the way.
Absolutely. But how do you go against the grain like this? Because the vast majority of Wall Street and economists seems to think the opposite of you.
All right, Tess, you know how, you know, sometimes things stick in your mind, and I may be giving you more insight than you want into what I'm attracted to. But Jerry Jordan, he was head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland in the 1990s, and boy, was he an inflation hawk. He hated inflation. He was tough on inflation. Well, he gave this speech, and in this speech, it's just always stuck with me. He said, look, how can it be that more people working, earning an income, and paying taxes can debauch the value of a currency? And all inflation is that a dollar today mm-hmm. is worth less tomorrow. That's why we don't like inflation. And I think that he's right. There is some unemployment in our economy no matter what. People quit their jobs. They say, I can't stand this boss. I'm going to get out of here. And of course, companies, they have to lay off people. And there's a gap between when people get laid off and they get a new job. Okay. But I don't know if that's a 1% unemployment rate. But what I do know is that a 4.5% unemployment rate is way too high. and it has nothing to do with inflation.
What would it cost us to guarantee everybody a job?
Well, this is where Edmund Phelps, he's Nobel laureate 2006, economist at Columbia University, has been doing some fascinating work in this area. And what it would be is a system of employment subsidies to employers to hire low-wage workers and pay them a decent wage. In other words, this is concentrated on those who are most vulnerable in our high-tech global economy, the low-skilled, low-wage worker. And he comes up with a figure that basically is going to cost the same as what we're spending to wage war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And by the way, we're doing that, and this economy is continuing to grow.
All right, my friend. Politically, is this at all possible?
No. And I don't understand why. Why is this not at the top of everybody's list? It's a pro-market solution because you're saying we want globalization. And in fact, by the way, let's get rid of a lot of these tariffs and any other barriers to trade that are going on. But what we're going to focus our dollars on is bringing everybody into the workforce that everybody can contribute. And by the way, in the long run, it's just not that much money.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, we'll definitely keep you employed for a long time to come.
And that I like to hear.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, banks don't always want your money.
Banks would rather make $1 million loan to one person than 10 $100,000 loans because financially it's more economically feasible for them.
One way to avoid loans is to get a raise. We've got some suggestions on how to ask for one in the latest Money Clip video. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Steve Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Eyre. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.